The Athletic.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for listening to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell, joined by Liam Tharm, by Mark Carey, and by Michael Cox. Morning, guys.
Morning. Good morning.
Good week it's been in the UEFA Champions League, and that's our focus today. All four quarterfinals very nicely poised after one leg, and within the games as well. Interesting swings of momentum in Arsenal and Bayern. Both teams had the lead and gave it up and drew 2-2. In Manchester City against Real Madrid, same story. Both teams had the lead. Man City had it twice and both gave it up. 3-3 the final score. On Wednesday night, PSG and Barcelona both had the lead. And in the end, Barca nicked it from a set play, a 3-2 win in Paris. And Atletico against Dortmund, it looked like plain sailing for Atleti. 2-0 up at half-time, but Dortmund came roaring back and scored 2-1 at the Wanda Metropolitano. Michael, what a treat for lovers of Champions League knockout football this week has been.
It was really good. I think the only shame is that there were only two time slots, so we couldn't watch all four games live. It always feels like the second round stretched out over four separate midweeks. The quarterfinals take place in a pretty short period of time. So yeah, it was great. Loads of goals, obviously, in all the games. And yeah, just really action-packed. It was quite fun watching one while seeing the updates from another. Because, I mean, I was watching Arsenal-Bayern and seeing the updates from Real City. It looked absolutely incredible. And then when I actually went back and watched the game, I mean, you had five goals, but you only had, I think, a combined 1.5 XG or something. Yeah. Just incredible shots again and again.
A lot of good finishing, some good goalkeeping, a couple of shots crashing against woodwork in particular in the Atletico Dortmund game. Michael, over the years, we've gone back and forth a bit about the away goals rule and its removal from these sorts of ties. I think one of the concerns about what would happen after its removal would be a lack of ambition from away teams in games like this, where one of the incentives of them attacking and scoring goals had been removed. Small sample size here, but you know, clearly attacking football hasn't been blunted. Is that maybe more of a reflection on how elite level football is being played at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't disappointed the away goals went because of the attack, the incentive to attack kind of thing. I just thought it was fun when you had a kind of slightly imbalanced scoreline in the second leg. Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. At the moment, I think top level football is very attack minded, very positive. I actually thought looking at these games, a few of the sides were much cagier than I think you would usually see them play. And to me, it seems like there's been a slight shift towards being conservative in Europe. I mean, if you watched the way Bayern Munich played, the way Barcelona played, the way Real Madrid played, it wasn't like they were saying, we're going to completely dominate this game with and without the ball. I thought they're a little bit more cautious, a little bit more functional, trying to get the job done. And I think the scorelines, I mean, particularly in the City-Real Madrid game, I don't think all the scorelines really reflect the nature of the games. Mm. I think they were broadly open, but I mean, they weren't kind of 2-3 this kind of... It looks like there was absolute chaos. In terms of goals, there was. But I thought a few of the games were actually a little bit more structured than that would suggest.
And that's where I really enjoy breaking down elite knockout level football, Liam, whether it's at club level or perhaps in major international tournaments, is that we are still conditioned to look at ways of analysing the game, looking at underlying numbers, whether that's shot related or otherwise. But at this stage of the season, a lot of it comes down to execution in both boxes.
Yeah, that's literally it. We're saying that it's often teams with the best goalkeeper or high level goalkeeper, sort of good level forwards that are going to make the difference. And kind of between both boxes is you're trying to reduce the error more than anything else, or keep it as controlled and sort of predictable as possible, and then make that space for your match winners, your star players, to really shine.
Let's start at the Emirates. Arsenal 2, Bayern 2. Bukayo Saka putting Arsenal ahead, and then Bayern hitting them back through Gnabry and a penalty from Harry Kane. But lovely play from Gabriel Jesus led to Trossard firing home an equaliser. Michael, a lot of excitement around Arsenal this season on the domestic front, and they are one of the favourites to win the Champions League as well. What did you make of how they handled this tie against Bayern Munich?
Well, I think the interesting thing was that Arteta went with Kiwior at left back. ahead of Zinchenko. And it's funny that Guardiola and Arteta, well, particularly Guardiola, was kind of the pioneer of using that fullback coming inside into midfield. They've both broadly gone away from that in the big games. I mean, we saw the Arsenal City game, four centre-backs against four centre-backs, and both ended, or both tried to be quite cautious this week. I completely understand why you would go for Kirior, because up against Leroy Sané, you think, well, let's go for a better defender. I think it's pretty clear that Zinchenko's not good in one-against-one duels. But I think this showed that actually Kirior, he's not perfect himself. You know, he was a little bit caught on his heels for the first goal. I think probably more Gabriel Raya's mix-up than his error. And then for the second goal, you know, he was unable to stop Sané turning him and sprinting towards goal. So, you know, if you're looking at Zinchenko, you're saying, well, he gives you things with possession, but he's going to be vulnerable defensively. Playing the centre-back there isn't a guarantee you're going to be solid defensively either. And I thought actually when Zinchenko came on at half-time, Arsenal's passing was much improved. And Zinchenko overhit a few passes and conceded possession. But that's the price you pay for a little bit of, you know, intended penetration of Bayern's lines. So I think that's an interesting debate because City did the same thing in Madrid. Okay, it's different because you've got John Stones stepping forward, but you've got Akanji playing at right back, who I really like Akanji as a centre-back. I don't particularly like him when he's in one of those wider areas.
Yeah, I think in terms of Arsenal's press as well, that it puts a lot of demands on the fullbacks to be good defensively just because of how hard the wingers go a lot of the time. I think particularly Saka on the right-hand side, but Martinelli too, where they're making these really aggressive sprints out to the opposition fullbacks. That was really clear. In fairness, I thought Arsenal actually pressed really, really quite well given the quality of the team they're up against, knowing that, you know, that scrap between sort of Gabriel and Harry Kane of he's definitely going to come in and you can then get those wingers or a midfielder sort of running beyond the ball. When you've got the threat of, you know, Gnabry, Sané, Musiala running beyond, you go, this has all got to be right or they're going to completely get through us. Mm. And obviously, as it was, the two moments really where things sort of fell apart, they conceded from and just didn't track around this very well and sort of turned over the ball. The second goal, the build-up to the penalty, I should say, is a really good sort of flowing move. But I think that's probably Arsenal's biggest weak spot just in terms of the personnel of... I think Benjamin White's there to be good going forward. He's quite good athletically, I think, but not quite as maybe strong or as dominant or as quick. And the same with Kivior on the side. Definitely good aerially. I think anything that was into the back four in the air, they really ate up and have done all season, to be honest. We've said that enough. But when you can get those wingers who are confident and good enough to actually take a touch, spin and go, that's your way of breaking the press.
Martinelli was hooked for the eventual goal scorer Trossard as well. That's Arsenal's left side, perhaps not having been at their best. Very clear how much they favoured the right side of their attack, which is nothing new, but looking at who scored 56% of their attacks down one side of the pitch, Mark, that's pretty stark.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that they sort of attacked it in that way so specifically. It was so high. I think it was one of the highest they've had in all competitions this season, especially when you think of Alphonso Davies being so blisteringly fast against Saka. But then, of course, Saka is such a threat himself. You've got the rotations with Odegaard and Ben White was running really well off Saka, who's sometimes rolling inside. And Ben White was pinning Gnabry back as well, which I thought was really interesting. But I think now that Alphonso Davies got a yellow card, he's out of the second leg, which I think will be interesting to see how they sort of approach that. I think there were times where they were trying to do the overload on the right-hand side to try and isolate Martinelli on the left-hand side, which didn't work all that well. But yeah, I think overall it was worthwhile because the first goal initially came from Saka, which was a fantastically taken goal as well.
Yeah, and that was a pattern they really tried down that sort of right-hand side. Odegaard was really dripping out, I think more than I've seen him do in a long time. That when you think you've got Jorginho and you've got Declan Rice in that team, okay, Rice has played a bit more as a number eight recently, but two players that are typically sort of defeat, they're going to link in that first phase so they can drop out of the Bayern sort of 4-4-2 block. And I guess it was just trying to find ways to manipulate that. I mean, that's how Arsenal defend themselves, so they know the ways to sort of try and find the solution. But yeah, I do wonder how much of it was sort of a deliberate ploy and also maybe being a little bit risk averse. They hardly played any sort of passes centrally into Havertz. There was nothing really in defeat. There was quite a lot in behind, which obviously is how they then counter-press, and there's Havertz's role there for the goal. And there's another chance, I think, sort of 5 minutes later that happens very similarly. So we're interested to see what they do in the second leg in terms of personnel and in terms of how they actually approach playing into the nine, whether they do take a few more risks. Obviously, then they're going to open themselves up to counter-attacks.
Yeah, Odegaard and Rice were playing essentially as fullbacks at times in possession. They're pulling so far outside of Bayern's rigid 4-4-2, and it was really strong, and they couldn't sort of penetrate all that much, which was, it felt a bit like the Porto game, they're horseshoeing around the block quite a lot and not kind of going through it. But when Jesus came on, I did think he was really good. He's always been really good at that, receiving with his back to goal and just having such tight, close control. And the fact that he can then attract players towards him then creates disruption elsewhere, and the likes of Odegaard can sort of feed off the back of it. And that's how the Trossard goal came about, that Jesus is just, he's a bit chaotic at times in a good way in possession, in that you don't know which way he's going to go. Maybe two or three players go towards him, and then Trossard obviously runs off the back and finishes first time. So I don't know whether bringing Jesus in might be potentially worthwhile for the second leg, but then Havertz is so good out of possession. We've spoken before about his all-round game if it's not sort of contributing towards goals. So it'd be tough. I wonder, yeah, how they'll go about it in terms of the front line next week.
There was one aspect of Arsenal's first goal that we've seen time and time again and has been highlighted as one of their moves, and that is when Ben White plays the pass perfectly into Saka's sort of left-footed shooting slot, if you like, so that he doesn't even have to break stride and ideally doesn't need to take a touch in order to get the angle and get the opportunity to shoot. There was one thing that really took my breath away, Michael, in the build-up to Bayern's second goal, the 2-1 goal, and that was Manuel Neuer's scoop-flicked pass over an Arsenal attacker out to the right-hand side. Now, annoyingly, it wasn't very accurate and it almost went out of play for a throw-in to Arsenal. So I can't work out whether I thought it was one of the best and coolest things I've ever seen a goalkeeper do in a massive game, or like, oh, that was actually maybe a bit too risky.
Yeah, weirdly, I have thought previously that method of playing the ball could be quite useful in the modern era, where everything's about passing lanes and trying to block off routes. And obviously it's quite hard to actually, in a shorter distance, quite hard to chip a ball accurately over a player to their feet. If you do just, you know, if you've got time to just chip it up and loft it from, you know, 50 centimetres off the floor, it can be quite useful. Yeah. I mean, I know it was showboating really, but he couldn't have played the pass straight because the player was there. Chipping it, I think, the ball tends to be in the air a bit too long.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the way he played it did kind of make sense.
Especially in the first half, where Arsenal were shepherding the ball towards Eric Dier and forcing him onto his left foot, and he was just basically having to play channel balls that were hopeless balls, and Arsenal were just regaining it and sustaining attacks really well. The idea was that they were going to shepherd it again, and he was going to be forced into playing it towards Eric Dier, and then he did the switcheroo and just completely flicked over, and then the goal came from that, which is to De Ligt, and then played it up the line. So
Brilliant. It
was, you know, Arsenal's strength then suddenly became their weakness. Yeah. So it worked.
And then followed up with Sané running half the pitch in one straight line before winning a penalty scored by Harry Kane. Has he added that little hop to his penalties? Because Raya did not pick that, did he?
He said afterwards, Kane, that he'd done research on what Raya did for the penalties in the shootout against Porto. And saw that he went quite early, so he said he waited.
Like ridiculously
early. I
love that.
I think it's brilliant.
Like ridiculously early. Mm. They showed it from the reverse angle, and he's taken about three steps. And Kane decelerates actually on the run-up, and he's a tiny glance up. And when he's probably about, before he's even taken that penultimate step on his left foot, he's looked up and Raya's already, he's completely gone. So I guess, you know, that's how early you've got to go if you do want to try and get across to save the trademark one across him. But yeah, it's makes so much sense.
But it is a trademark one. I think that's why they're trying to predict. I saw in another interview from Kane that he's like, I know that goalkeepers know that is my preferred side. So
it's a percentage play, isn't it, from the goalkeepers, which makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great result for Bayern to, despite giving up that lead, to take a, I would suggest, a draw back to Munich. What did you make of how they set up, Michael? What did Bayern do well, or perhaps what might be areas that they might need to look at for the second leg?
Quite cautious, I thought. I mean, a 4-4-2 out of possession, kind of mid-block, wasn't really anything too exciting, almost back to basics. I thought they were okay, reasonably well organised.
Do they press really high, even with Kane at the top of the pitch in the Bundesliga?
When I've seen them, they've pressed higher than that. I mean, it's not all out, but... Yeah, I think Kane's always been reasonably good at. He's not necessarily someone who's, you know, sprinting, but he's always in. He understands the task.
Hard worker.
Musiala backs him up really well. I like the two in midfield. I think Lima and Goretzka, they're good all rounders. They're physical, they're mobile. They're both good in possession. I thought Goretzka made a really good forward run for the first goal as well. So they're all right. I mean, considering Bayern have been a bit shambolic at times in recent months. I thought that was a pretty good performance.
I know it was said on site on The Athletic in our briefing after the game that the game sort of broadly suited Bayern, and I do agree with that in terms of the onus isn't on them to dominate the play and have a lot of possession, which is why they didn't need to necessarily press high because they're allowing themselves more space to exploit, with especially in wide areas with Leroy Sané. And I know Kingsley Coman came on as well. And I looked into the numbers on this. They've only had a lower share of possession in all competitions this season once against Stuttgart, and that was 38% in December, and they won 3-0. And in this game, they only had 41% as well. So that was, you know, playing to a bit more of their strength of counter-attacking with pace and purpose, with Kane dropping in and obviously the wide players being able to exploit those spaces. The only thing I'd say is I wonder whether when they play, you know, back at home, the pride of the Bayern Munich fans, the club, etc., will expect them to dominate the game and have more possession. And then that might actually kind of tactically hamper them more. Or do they play, not underdog football, but do they maybe allow themselves to cede possession at home, which would actually be maybe more of a strength?
It is fascinating how this tie will look in the second leg after, you know, what you guys have said, particularly because the wingers being high and wide and very, very pacey, and Kane's ability to drop deep and spin balls in behind Michael is just such an incredible threat to have. And that is made easier if you are perhaps dropping a little bit deeper out of possession in order to have more space to play into. But Mark's point about the atmosphere at the Allianz, the pride, if you like, how might that second leg look?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it will look too different to this one. I think Arsenal will play in a similar way, Bayern maybe be a little bit more aggressive. But yeah, obviously, it is a tough place to go. And it's funny you mentioned the fans, because obviously there was no Bayern fans at all at this game. Mm. And there was an incident in the second half where I think it was Ødegaard snuck up behind one of the Bayern players and robbed him right in front of where the Bayern fans would have been. A shout of man on, and I don't think that would have happened. So, small details, eh?
At the same time, Real Madrid and Manchester City were playing an incredibly entertaining game. 6 goals, split evenly. Guys, just out of personal interest, when there's 2 games going on at the same time, are you dual screeners? Do you try and take in both at the same time, or can you just not, you know, do you get the worst of both worlds if you try and do that?
Yeah, I think you end up, if you watch both, you often don't even see half of each one.
Right.
So I actually didn't watch either of the games live on Tuesday night. I was watching West Ham under-21s against Lyon PSV.
That is so Liam Tharm.
So I watched them one after another on a rewatch. Wednesday night, I was writing on the PSG game, so I had to give that my full attention. But I found if I'm going to watch 2 games, it needs to be more, dare I say it, for fun than like work purposes. Mm. So I can just sort of like have a bit of appreciation for both.
I think if you watch 2 games, you watch 0 games, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my philosophy.
If you watch the central defensive midfielder, if you watch Busquets, you see the whole game.
If you watch 2 Busquets.
And then the sort of cousin of that is if you follow the referee as a central midfielder, you'll always be in the best position of the pitch.
Running diagonally across the pitch.
Oh, football's got some good maxims. This was a bonkers, basically. Yeah. 3 goals between the second minute, albeit the free kick itself that came from it was given away even earlier than that. And the 14th minute was when the third goal went in. The first goal scored by Bernardo from a free kick, catching out the goalkeeper of Real Madrid. Don't want to pile on anyone here, but it's very notable given the performances of Thibaut Courtois for Real Madrid in this era where they have secured so many Champions League titles, that Thibaut Courtois not in goal for Real Madrid, and the sorts of goals being conceded that we don't expect it to be conceded at the Bernabeu. Liam?
Yeah, it was quite a bizarre free kick. I mean, it evoked memories, funnily enough, of Joe Bryan at Wembley for Fulham in the Perth final. And the exact sort of, again, when sort of Kane speaks about the penalties and looking at Ryan, sort of just seeing tendencies, they're the exact sort of details that you feel like come out even more important in knockout European ties, where, you know, teams that score first, I think the rates of winning when you score first are even higher than in the league, as teams will go ahead and they'll just completely sit back or, you know, try and defend that lead even more intensely. So yeah, just quite an awkward goal to watch because he gets quite a good hand to it. And in fairness, from looking at Lunin's shot stopping numbers, he's had quite a good season in La Liga for all intents and purposes. So yeah, just really smart from, again, someone we've done a whole podcast on about being the best player in the league.
I don't know what was more calamitous of that, like the fact that he didn't quite get to it when he probably should have saved it, or his organisation of the wall. And I saw some post-match analysis with Thierry Henry saying he broke it down so simply, he just said, two on the ball, i.e. Jack Grealish and Bernardo Silva were on the ball, two in the wall. And they just had, and he only had Vinicius Jr.
Are we sure that's not just good because it rhymes?
but it was
catches
true.
Catches win matches.
But it, we're speaking about all the maxims today, but it was true where Vinicius Jr. shifted across, maybe thinking it was going to be taken by a right footer, and he just opened up that whole space. And then the goalkeeper is stranded a little bit, or basically having to cover the whole goal. So should Lunin have directed his wall to make sure that there's enough space so that would have just been stopped before it could even begin, or should he have just done better with the save? I don't know.
I'll also say that the foul from Aurelien Tchouaméni in the build-up is classic, like, defensive midfielder playing at centre-back.
Why is Tchouaméni playing at centre-back? I took my eye off Real Madrid for a few weeks, all of a sudden, you know, this great...
Yeah, injuries, I think, Militao and Nacho. So, but
both on the bench, so one of them will have to play in the second leg. Suspended.
Yeah, that's true. I think Militao's just now come back, because I think he played a few minutes in La Liga, but isn't fully fit to sort of start. And
not surprised Militao's injured. My main memory of him in the Champions League knockout stage last season was being down on the floor injured for most of the games that Real Madrid played. Real came flying back, Camavinga letting fly from range, big deflection off Ruben Dias. And then we saw a winger high and wide, outside to in run, in behind a high line and scoring. That was Rodrigo. Is that maybe a little bit similar to Bayern's approach against Arsenal? Is that just the most dangerous that Real Madrid can be?
I think so. I mean, if I had memories recently, obviously when Vinicius and Rodrigo played really similarly against England at Wembley. Obviously, I think Guardiola spoke after is about saying if you have Kyle Walker there, then naturally you've got, I think the antidote was sort of the word that's used, is someone that can then just match either of them for pace. And as Michael sort of said, with Akanji being out there, who is probably the better profile compared to Rico Lewis or someone else. But it's just that
the better
speed.
Profile to handle...
So yeah, to defensively, I think so. And yeah, it's just then the challenge that the City have, that they're, we've spoken a lot about their sort of defensive transition issues. And I wonder now if they start to sort of compound their own problems by having so many to feet players in the final third, that I know it almost sounds silly to have Jeremy Doku off the right because you then think he's going to dribble and you have more turnovers. But I think just to turn the game into a few more set pieces, to win more fouls, to break the game up more, have more speed down that side and more directness. Whereas a lot of the time, and there are a couple occasions where Foden gets tackled, Bernardo again is very technical, very much a passer, not a dribbler. I do wonder if they just end up actually having more turnovers there, and then there are a few occasions where the counter press wasn't quite on it and it has to be, and inside a couple passes, you know, Real Madrid have got their runners going and suddenly you go, oh my God, City are all over the place here. So it was, again, they've got to find more solutions now for their, you know, defending of counterattacks.
Well, it was quite uncharacteristic that City were quite sloppy in midfield as well. I think Rodri just played a diagonal that went straight out of play, and it was a, I think they said in commentary, it was a collector's item because it was just unpressured. He was just being quite sloppy on the ball. I don't know why that was. But yeah, it's been City's kryptonite of sort of conceding in the transition in general. But again, looked into the numbers and they conceded 3 shots from fast breaks against Madrid. Now, that's more than any other Champions League game since 2018-19. And that's only from when I have data, so there's probably maybe even going further back. So it shows how much they do typically like to seek out that control. We know that to be the case, even in knockout football. But they just didn't have it for long periods. And if you look at the things like the match momentum from companies like Opta, normally you'd see City have long periods of domination. And they just didn't really. They just couldn't quite get a stranglehold on the game, knowing full well that Real Madrid have got such individuals to be able to punish them at any moment.
One of the things that fascinated me, and then looking at how Real set up, especially compared to sort of City in wide areas, was having, it's very two-footed, Toni Kroos, but a dominant right footer on the left of midfield and a left footer in Eduardo Camavinga on the right of midfield. Obviously, he played fullback in this fixture last season and came inside, but so the goalie then gets to equalise, almost reminiscent of a winger coming in and sort of shooting. But you just don't see many teams now. And I know that, you know, Ancelotti is never really someone that is I think unfairly actually praised for his sort of tactical nous or ways of working and ways of constructing a team. We'll play a diamond sometimes and isn't always probably put on the Guardiola levels of being an innovator and whatnot. But it worked really well because the simple, you know, focus was we can push Carvajal, the right back, up onto the last line. We can hit switches. They seemed to be quite good actually at playing long, but also avoiding aerial duels because City just had a much bigger back line. But when they could get one of the wingers, a bit like when we were speaking with Bayern, actually away from a fullback or away from a defender and get that first touch and get 5 yards off the dribble, they were really, really dangerous and really, really good. So I'm intrigued to see how City try and defend that if you have to go maybe more intense in the press to try and stop sort of Kroos or Camavinga getting on the ball as much. Because I think for most of the first half, City were like pushed up high, but not really engaging particularly aggressively. It wasn't what we'd seen from, you know, the Bayern game last season where, sure, this will probably be different at home where they can go sort of full court press, but they weren't suffocating in their typical City way.
It's worth noting as well, just speaking of tactical tweaks, that we spoke about Rodrigo before, and it was him who started more as the left winger. That, obviously, that was where the goal came from, Vinicius kind of dropping in a little bit. But typically it has been, as we know, Vinicius being the one on the far left side. I'm not exactly sure why that was the case, why that was chosen, but it seemed to work really well of Rodrigo just making those penetrative runs. He is maybe underestimated for how quick he is as well as Vinicius, but they were obviously linking up, as Liam mentioned before. And he's got 16 goals and has got 8 assists for Madrid this season in all competitions, which I think he's on for his best season in terms of his goal output. And you just think of it in terms of, I feel like maybe it's just my view from the outside looking in, but he's kind of always underestimated. Everyone's talking about Vinicius Jr., talking about Jude Bellingham, Endrick's coming in the summer, potentially Kylian Mbappe as well. And you just think, like, he's always just sort of saying, like, I'm still here. I'm still really good, still really young. And he's been a thorn in the side of Manchester City in previous years, particularly at the Bernabeu, where he scored 2 in 2 minutes as well. So City are probably sick of Rodrigo as much as anyone.
Big game records are nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just the one attempt at goal from Haaland. He's only scored in 6 of his last 17 appearances for Manchester City. Thankfully,
that's like a fine record, no? 1 in 3 for, you know, his bar is
yes,
so high.
A victim of his own success, yeah, and quality. Yeah. But is this is interesting to me, Liam? Mm-hmm. Sorry, if you'll let me finish. This is interesting to me because last season we had a few discussions about Haaland's absurd goal return being incredibly impressive on an individual level, but City as an attack broadly being the same. They didn't score more goals as a team. Their underlying numbers were no better as a team. And so there's the discussion about, you know, what's better, having one player scoring a high proportion of your goals or spreading them around. City haven't had too many issues scoring in the stretch that I've mentioned, where Haaland himself hasn't been scoring too much. Is there anything deep in that, Michael? Has Pep thought to himself, I'd rather be the team that spreads it around a bit. So don't worry, Erling, we're not going to create as much for you. We're going to try and spread it around. This is what I'm getting at. That's what I'm trying to work out.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, he doesn't contribute that much without the ball, so he's not contributing to spreading it around a bit in terms of assisting or anything. I think that is important. And I think it's worth pointing out, Guardiola used to have Aguero and Gabriel Jesus when they were, you know, when Aguero was a really good player, Jesus was up and coming, very useful. And often he didn't use a centre forward in these big games. He would often play Jesus out wide, Aguero a couple of times, or he'd leave him out. So I think he just feels he has to start Haaland. I could be wrong, but I don't think there's been a single occasion in a big-ish game where he hasn't played Haaland. I wonder whether it is getting towards that point. Because I think in certain situations, Alvarez could be a better option here. I mean, Haaland's obviously a very physical player, and I thought it was interesting, you know, Rudiger almost played like a, you know, kind of stepped up and said, look, I'm playing alongside Tchouaméni, who's not a proper centre-back. I'm going to play really physically against Haaland. I don't think Haaland, at the moment, doesn't have any skill set really to just go and play 15 yards deeper, because I think if he does, he's not actually contributing that much. So, I don't know. I wonder whether if Haaland had less of a kind of status and a reputation, whether Guardiola would consider leaving him out and playing Alvarez in games like this.
I'll say I thought Rudiger was phenomenal. Quite a few instances, particularly from the goal kicks, where Haaland would be positioned really aggressively in the rail half, and obviously everyone else is pressed out of the pitch, but Rudiger's there deep with him and, you know, prepared to engage physically and really go sort of toe-to-toe. I wonder again if there was the downside of Ortega being an excellent backup, but not quite having the sheer kicking distance of Edison. If Haaland's big strength really sort of going in behind, having, you know, the one of the probably what the best distributor in world football there, and would be really, really useful. Maybe missing De Bruyne a little bit as well, having a right footer, I think, particularly creating from that side. I know it's something Mark's looked at and made a really good point. I think it was earlier this season where you're saying that, you know, having Foden as a left footer and really good, really technical in tight areas, a great turner, but I think he just does, his tendency to cross or pass probably isn't quite as quick as De Bruyne, which is probably an unfair bar to set because De Bruyne is the best in the world at that. But yeah, even the tendency of having a left footer who's probably going to chip crosses more to the back post if he's off the right, or sort of look for combinations down the left, I think when you get De Bruyne off that right hand side to whip those crosses in, he's phenomenal. It took an hour to get that trademark sort of City number 10 running inside the fullback, and again, that's probably a team style thing for what Guardiola wanted this game.
Well, Foden's finishing has been absolutely incredible recently, and perhaps his best of the lot here, just an incredibly powerful and accurate strike into the top corner to equalise for 2-2. Gvardiol, something of a surprise goal scorer, and particularly the manner in which it was scored, a right-footed sort of thump from range, found the corner of the net, and then Valverde with such a sweet connection on a volley from a Vinicius ball across for 3-3. That one finally poised. Do we expect to see Ederson back in goal, De Bruyne back in the starting 11 for a home game where City are and have been recently so much more comfortable and almost unbeatable at home in the Champions League?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think Ederson is just a better goalkeeper to start with. And De Bruyne, I gather, was a bit ill, so that's why he missed out. But yeah, I think they'll both be back.
Big swings in Paris, where Barcelona won 3-2 against Paris Saint-Germain. What were the initial sort of key tactical aspects of this game, Michael?
Well, it was great because there was a press conference the day before where Luis Enrique was asked who played the more Barcelona DNA football at Barcelona, and Luis Enrique was like, me. look at the trophies, look at the stats, look at the performances. And so I thought it was quite interesting because actually they played quite a similar way, I would say, in this game. They played kind of 4-3-3 with both sides forming a front five with the left back pushing really high, Nuno Mendes for PSG, João Cancelo for Barcelona, who I want to love him, but I don't love a right-footed player in that situation where he's being the outside left. I know he can use his left foot. I know he can use the outside of his right foot. But, I mean, when you had someone like Balde there who was more of a natural in terms of positionally and stretching the play, I think that works a little bit better. But it was interesting. I mean, I think Barcelona, you could say, they kind of had a similar approach to how we spoke about Bayern. It was a 4-4-2 mid-block without the ball. You don't really expect to see that kind of thing from Barcelona. But I thought certain elements of the game they did very well. And the thing they did best, you could argue, was very much not Barcelona DNA because it was the long balls into attack.
Yeah, I love this. So I've got the numbers on this of Marc-Andre Ter Stegen playing the long balls kind of into Lewandowski and the likes of Rafinha just feeding off Lewandowski. It felt very the year 2000 Sunday League sort of vibes, and I absolutely loved it. So I looked into it. 20 long balls were played by Ter Stegen across the whole game. That's the highest he has had in La Liga and the Champions League this season. 56 as a share of his total, 56% of his total passes were long balls, which is also the highest share as well. So very clear tactic. I'd be interested to hear what the guys think of that in terms of, was it intentional to beat PSG's press? They're not exactly known for their suffocating high press, or was it just to play direct? There's plenty of space in behind.
I think a bit of both. Very good commentator answer that. They've tried to do that more this season under Luis Enrique, and obviously having Dembele and Mbappe to lead the press, they really dropped Asensio sort of out wide left to press the fullback, and were basically engaging man for man, leaving a 3v3 in halfway. And I was slightly baffled, and so they've had injuries at centre-back this season. They're missing players there. Nnoudi Moukiele as well, who probably would have played off the left. And Hakimi was suspended for this game. But Luis Enrique put Marquinhos, like their captain, their primary centre-back, out on the right-hand side, maybe to defend Rafinha, I don't know, and left a very young Lucas Berardo in the middle up against Lewandowski. And it was quite clear inside 5 minutes, the passes Mark speaks about, Lewandowski was really smart. He'd stand offside, and as to Stegen, who kicked really far, basically lined up to kick it, he'd step into Beraldo, who was then too far advanced because he doesn't want to play Lewandowski on side. And Lewandowski would just block him off, and Rafinha could try and sort of run in behind. So it did work really, really well. And really, I think when you look at the players they've got, I thought Kubasi was really good. Very, you know, young centre back off the left, plays a great ball into Lewandowski in the build up to the opening goal, where again he spins off the defender. But it's almost like the context of the game of saying, you know, you've got a few youngsters in the team. You're wanting to not go behind or not let them get into the game early, stopping Mbappe having space to sort of play into and making those regains close to goal, and the same with their defensive approach of being quite compact and not engaging too high. I thought Xavi, he spoke very clearly about that, being like, it's a new Barca. We're kind of content to do things a little bit differently. And Luis Enrique's way of playing didn't really work in the first half, and they scored twice after making halftime changes.
Yeah, I thought Koundé and Araujo dealt with Mbappe really well. We can come on to the tactical tweaks at halftime that helped PSG, but Kubasi was fantastic again, on and off the ball. I know that Xavi gave him a mention after the game, saying sort of how well he jumped really high on Kangin Lee and Marco Asensio at times, just to be really aggressive. And there were times where he was kind of midway into the opposition half to really press high, and trusting himself at such a young age was outstanding. He became the youngest defender in Champions League history to start a quarterfinal match, for those interested. Thank you to Opta for that. The final thing on Barca would be that Rafinha played really well off the left again. I know that he did it against Napoli, and he's done it a couple of times this season. But, you know, typically he's more comfortable on the right, and we know him from his time in the Premier League on the right-hand side. But he was really effective on the left-hand side, getting those flick-ons. And in total, he had 6 shots, which was more than anyone else on the pitch. And he came off after 76 minutes as well. So obviously got the goal as well, but overall performance from Rafinha was really strong.
PSG's approach from the outset was interesting. They played Marco Asensio basically, I don't know what he was really. I don't know whether he was a proper number 9 or a false number 9, which isn't a great kind of assessment or positive assessment of his
performance.
We're
going to need a new name for something here.
But what just was false. Interesting was I thought he defended the left flank quite a lot. Yeah. And that's presumably just to allow Mbappe complete freedom from defensive responsibility. Mbappe does seem to enjoy this luxury, almost regardless of what teams he plays for. It was a similar situation with France at the World Cup just a year ago. So I thought that was an interesting quirk, but it didn't really work out at all. And I thought, to be honest, I thought Barcelona were fantastic for the first half. I thought PSG got completely outplayed and, of course, got back into it in the second half.
Yeah, and they that first sort of 10 minutes for PSG in the second half was quite swashbuckling. And it was intentional because it was from that change from Luis Enrique. So they brought Marco Asensio off, put Dembele more onto the left-hand side, sort of link up more closely with Kylian Mbappe, and they brought Bradley Barcola onto to the right-hand side, which I thought was just interesting as well, that João Cancelo as a right-footed left-back and Bradley Barcola as a right-footed, right-sided attacker was... You don't really see that nowadays, and it was quite interesting to see in general there, but also just how much Barcola was making some really good off-ball runs, really trying to stretch the Barcelona defence and sort of create more gaps. And it was from that, especially the second goal that Vitinha scored, where there was more gaps being exploited, more rotation to actually start to test Barcelona's defence, which they didn't really do in the first half. And defensively, they changed as well, didn't they? So Marquinhos came more as a centre-back, and Hernandez, I think, came more as a right-back.
So they had a left-footed right-back.
Yeah, it was all a bit sort of confusing. Yeah. But those rotations, which were... They rotated quite a lot in terms of the attack in the first half, but it didn't quite work. But especially for the first 10 to 15 minutes of that second half, with the changes, they got back into the game, and they were 2-1 up before you know it.
I think that is the post-Mbappe system that we're going to see more of, possibly specifically for Europe, possibly to be in Ligue 1 as well. But theoretically, you can shift Barcola to the left when you take out Mbappe. You leave Dembele in that sort of number 10 role that Mark was speaking about, and it showed really, really well. They first sort of did this away to Real Sociedad in the last round, up against a really intense press. So it was a bit different here, where it's more into mid-block. But having Dembele's press resistance there is really, really essential. I mean, this was Asensio's first start in the Champions League, which, for someone that I don't think has been injured all that much this season, it's weird to hand someone a first start that isn't like typically a key player. And they look so much more dynamic. The two goals come from, you know, as Mark said, in very quick succession, just because they get more runners sort of beyond the ball. I think it's Mbappe overlapping Dembele in the build-up to the first, has a cutback, gets cleared. You know, it's a really powerful finish on the angle. And then in the second one, I think it's Kangin Lee who overlaps Barcola. And then you get that connection playing back round, and you get Vitinha, who has been really, really good this season. And they've got a lot of good technical midfielders that can play beyond the ball. So getting them to be able to sort of crash into the box and attack that way is really, really important.
As was the case in pretty much all of these games, some wonderful individual moments as well, whether it was the youngster Lamal's cross with the outside of his boot that led to Rafinha's goal. Dembele with a classic dummy shot, shift onto his left foot, smash into the top corner. The little run from Vitinha I thought was really nice in the build-up to his goal. And Pedri's assist to Rafinha. Ooh, talk about wedgery. That was
the right club.
Absolutely immaculate. And you know what? Sometimes you just want a big old meaty centre-back header from a set piece as well, just to finish the meal. I'm looking forward to the second leg, Liam. I'll certainly have my eyes on this one. Liam, for you, what happens back in Barcelona with Barca having the one-goal lead?
Well, obviously, they've got a lead to defend, and PSG need to come out and attack, and that's a bigger problem for them because they were really good when they went to Real Sociedad. But that's their only away win in the Champions League this season. They didn't win at all in the group stages. Sure, they were in a hard group, but you know, we saw them go to Newcastle and try something a little bit different in midfield and with more forwards and kind of get blown away. And they weren't particularly good in defending transition either in Milan. So I think if they set up how they did in the first half, they might have more problems in sort of trying to control the game. I think Luis Enrique, a lot of the seasons, wanted to try and win in a Barcelona-style way. And the one place he now needs to not go and do that is, ironically, I think, in Barcelona.
And in Madrid on Wednesday, Atletico take a slender lead to Germany, a 2-1 lead, Michael. And they were 2-0 up relatively early in this game. And the way that Dortmund's defence were handling themselves, or not, as the case was, made me feel that this could have got away from them, actually. As it was, they came roaring back in the second half. But what are the key takeaways from the start of this game?
Well, the two goals were similar and yet also completely different. They were similar because it was dreadful defending from Dortmund. But the first goal, they tried to play out and the centre-backs were nowhere to be seen because one was in a right-back position and the other was in a left-back position. They lost the ball. Atletico pressed and scored. And the second one, the defenders were on top of each other. There's too many defenders because both Schlotterbeck...
It wasn't very Champions League quarter-final-y.
No, both Schlotterbeck and Hummels went for the same ball. And Atleti got in behind them. It was a pretty poor start from Dortmund, I think you have to say. I thought the first goal was interesting because I think Simeone and Atleti are always very good at knowing when to press. They press not just when the ball's there to be won, which is obvious, but I think when the opposition have got themselves into a little bit of a bad shape. So Dortmund ended up with Mattsson, who was the left back, in the middle, Emre Can, who was the centre back, alongside him almost in defence, and the two centre-backs completely wide. And that's obviously a great situation to force a turnover. And I think they've done that really well over the years. Dortmund, to their credit, came back. And I mean, they really could have, that they hit the woodwork twice late on. So it sets it up for quite an interesting game. I mean, it was the only one of the four games that was a home win, and it's a home win by one goal. So even that sets it up quite nicely for the return leg, because you think the home side in Dortmund probably have a bit of an advantage. So yeah, it's very nicely set for the second leg.
I mean, yeah, Michael mentions a home win there. Looking at Atleti's record, it's unbelievable in terms of knockout. So I saw this from Opta that they've never lost a knockout tie in their own stadium in the Champions League under Simeone. And this was his 17th game of doing that. So it shows just how strong they are at home. They are not so strong away from home, and Dortmund are particularly strong in the Champions League at home as well. So something may give there in the second leg. But I agree with Michael again in terms of their out-possession play. And there's a really interesting piece from Dermot Corrigan, which is on site now, which says about how typically you associate Atleti or a Diego Simeone side of being kind of more of a deep block defensively and being really strong out of possession, which they are. But they were pressing really well as well, and they were pushing really high and being really strong out of possession. And they won possession in the attacking third 8 times in this game, which was the fourth most in La Liga and the Champions League this season. So they were preying upon Dortmund's sort of weaknesses. And you mentioned that it wasn't much of a Champions League quarterfinal sort of look in terms of those actions. But what I would say is that the fact that they were punished so much by just small mistakes is very kind of Champions League at this level. You can't afford to make even one pass that's wrong. And I think that the goalkeeper was, you know, he had the main error there, shouldn't have played it in the first place. But just within seconds, it's a goal. And then you're 1-0 down. And then before you know it, you try and atone for your errors, and then you're 2-0 down. So it was just really clinical from Atletico. And they are more high scoring than, again, I think the stereotype of Atleti would suggest. I think they've scored, if not the most and the joint most, maybe with Manchester City in the Champions League this season. So they are really sort of strong going forward, more than maybe people give them credit for.
The funny thing about them is that under Simeone, who's been there obviously for over a decade now, you wouldn't say that they're really easy on the eye or great to watch as a team. But actually, when you think about their matches always are good to watch. You know what I mean? Because they're almost always up against a side who plays, quote, better football than them. And they there's always just a really interesting stylistic contrast. So it's funny. Yeah, Atletico, I mean, if it was like a kind of season DVD, here's the highlights, they wouldn't be on top of my list of teams to watch. But sitting down to watch a knockout tie in the Champions League, I think they always produce great entertainment, great drama, usually pretty close games as well. So, yeah, to be honest, I hope they go through the semi-final because I think they're always good fun.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, on that note as well, they had 34% possession and 38% field tilt. But for most of the game, especially the first hour, they always looked like they were in control as well. So it's not like they were playing kind of underdog minnow football. But yeah, they are entertaining to watch because they are just, I mean, Rodrigo de Paul specifically, they're all kind of just pests. They, do you know what I mean? It's the only way I can describe them. When they are out of possession, they're just very aggressive. And Rodrigo de Paul is just the shining example of that. He's just, he'll win fouls, he'll foul the opposition. His goal obviously was coming from an aggressive press as well, but you know, people speak about him being Lionel Messi's bodyguard for the Argentine national team. Like, he's just kind of always there and really annoying, and he must just be a nightmare to play against, but that kind of makes it entertaining.
And it goes back to what I said at the start with, you know, there's a lot of traditionally very open, expansive footballing teams playing a lot more cautious, a lot more boxy. And they did it okay this week, but almost everyone conceded a lot of goals. Mm. And if it's going to be a Champions League where it's going to be won by a team who are really organised, really structured, happy defending deep, you know, maybe it could be Atleti's year.
I sort of get the sense that they've thrown away an unbelievable situation that they had at 2-0 up. You know, based on what we're saying here, their comfort out of possession, and to me, that leads to an idea. This would be a team that once they have the lead are going to, you know, be incredibly good at seeing it out. It wasn't really the case. I mean, they squandered more chances. There was a massive save by Kobel at 2-0. I think within 10 minutes, Dortmund had pulled one back. They finally squeezed a way through the middle, didn't they? You know, when I think of Atleti, even that classic team from the sort of 2013-14, I think of how you'd never penetrate them through the middle. You had to rely on like a good cross and a header, if anything. But Dortmund did squeeze a couple of passes through the middle, and the ball found its way to Haller, who finished well. He'd come off the bench for Füllkrug, and Brandt came off the bench for Nemeka. That did seem to make an impact for Dortmund. And I wonder whether in the home leg we may see a bit more Brandt. Maybe we see a bit more Haller. The notable thing statistically in an attacking sense for Dortmund is Sancho and Adeyemi, between them 19 dribbles attempted and 10 completed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a good point. It was really the only time that Dortmund did really penetrate Atleti's lines, which is the thing that led to the goal. But all of those dribbles were, yes, they were good, potentially easy on the eye, but they never really led to anything. And Sancho was swapping flanks quite a few times with Adeyemi to try and just get a bit of joy. And as I say, it didn't really lead to much, maybe the odd corner, but it was from when they just sort of made that kind of reverse pass that actually led to the goal. And I'm surprised that Brandt didn't start, to be honest. I think he looked a real threat when he came on. And Füllkrug has been having a really good season. Haller has, you know, got the goal. So they've got rotations, you know, options there. But yeah, it looked like they were far more of a threat when those changes were made.
I just absolutely love Antoine Griezmann. And watching this game only solidified that. What a wonderful player, what an intelligent player. His understanding of space and when to hold on to the ball, when to move it quickly, you know, the way he looks after it. He's obviously a very creative passer now, isn't he? I think underlying numbers-wise across Europe and in La Liga, you're looking at one of the most creative players from a central position. Less of a goal scorer maybe than he once was, but still liable to pop up with big goals. And it just made me reflect, Michael, on how he, Karim Benzema and Olivier Giroud, broadly in the same age bracket, French attackers, how incredibly they all extended their careers, even beyond, in Giroud and Griezmann's case, even beyond goal scoring, even when that sort of changed and they had to become different players. Like, speaks to, I don't know what it speaks to, but incredible mental strength and adaptability to be able to stay at the very top level.
Yeah, I think you're right to highlight the three of them, but I think particularly Griezmann, because Giroud has often been a substitute, hasn't always got minutes, Benzema didn't play for the France national team for quite an extended period, so he got rest. But Griezmann never misses a game. I mean, for club or country, I mean, he did miss one recently for France, but that was after 85 games where he'd started in a row. And he's changed his role as well. We used to think of him as a pacey forward, maybe a second striker. He can play as a number eight really well now. He's so tactically intelligent. I thought he was fantastic at the World Cup until the final where he was quite quiet. But yeah, one of the best footballers of this era.
It's a particularly impressive performance given his three children all had their birthday on Monday and all were born, and none of them are twins. They're all born on the same day in
That's
three different years.
Great fun.
Can I end on a stat of Griezmann that he created six chances in this game, which is more than any other game this season in La Liga or the Champions League. And it's his most ever in a Champions League game. And he's played 94 games. So it shows just how much of an impact he had this week.
What a performance from Antoine Griezmann, from Mark, from Michael, from Liam as well. We're all in on the Champions League knockout stages. All four of those quarterfinals beautifully poised. So no doubt we will be back again talking about them in a couple of weeks and trying to give you the best insight and coverage of the Champions League as it draws to its conclusion. Thank you for listening to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Make sure you sign up to The Athletic today at theathletic.com/tactics for a discount on an annual subscription and join us again next week.
The Athletic.